I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, they see you when you're sleeping. They know when you're awake. Just about. We're going to hear about the new targeting techniques in political campaigns. But first, the first Guantanamo War Crimes trial is underway, with Osama bin Laden's former driver and alleged bodyguard pleading not guilty today. Salim Hamdan from Yemen entered the plea through his lawyer at the U.S. naval base in Cuba. He's the first prisoner to face a U.S. war crimes trial since World War II. Meanwhile, Attorney General Michael Mukasey spoke about the other detainees today, saying Congress should step in to help figure out how to give them their day in court. Mukasey said last month's Supreme Court ruling giving detainees the right to challenge their detentions through the writ of habeas corpus left many questions unanswered, and it's the responsibility of lawmakers to answer them. Well, Evan Perez covered the speech for The Wall Street Journal. Evan, what is Attorney General Mukasey really saying here? Can we read between the lines? Is he saying that these cases should be taken away from the military commissions?
No, he's definitely not saying that. He believes that that process is legal and that in fact, they believe that the Supreme Court allows the decision allows for that process to continue. What he's talking about is trying to get Congress to pass legislation that would perhaps add some rules to the habeas process, to the process by which these detainees could challenge their detentions. And essentially, what he's saying is that we can't give them the full habeas as all other Americans are granted or have the right to. He's saying that there should be sort of a more limited, more practical process.
Well, he outlined several principles that he said should guide Congress as it considers these issues. Let's listen to one.
First and foremost, Congress should make clear that our federal court may not order the government to bring enemy combatants into the United States. There are more than 200 detainees remaining in Guantanamo Bay, and many of them pose an extraordinary threat to Americans.
Evan Perez, that's been the argument of the White House, but doesn't that essentially rob them of their ability to challenge their cases if they can't bring their case to Washington, D.C.?
Well, that's the point. The administration believes that the court doesn't explicitly say that, and so one of the things that what's happening here is, as you recall, the Supreme Court slapped the hands of the administration, saying, "Look, we've kind of given you some leeway here, and we've told you to that you have to give more rights to these people, and you keep coming back with half measures and sort of criticize the administration for the way they've responded to previous decisions." And so there's a lot of criticism today that perhaps this is another attempt by the administration to not fully comply with what the Supreme Court was saying.
Is it clear that if Congress can pass laws that would in effect overturn the Supreme Court decision?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the Supreme Court decision establishes that there is habeas, that there is a habeas right. What the administration is bargaining on is that that the Congress can pass legislation that will somehow thread the needle and satisfy both what the Supreme Court said is a right that these detainees have and the national security needs that they believe are imperative here.
Well, did the Attorney General say anything about the trial that is ongoing, the military trial that began today, Hamdan pleading not guilty to charges that he was involved in terrorism? He's, of course, the driver of Osama bin Laden.
No, he didn't address that the trial that began today. One of the interesting things that did happen is he talked about the need for Congress to pass some kind of for the legislation that Congress would pass for it to essentially reaffirm that we are in this conflict with Al Qaeda and the Taliban. And the question that came to him was, is there something that has happened that makes you believe that you're on weak footing here? And he said, well, no, we're pretty good. We think we're fine, but it wouldn't hurt to have Congress reaffirm and essentially do a declaration of war.
Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Evan, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
After today's meeting in Baghdad between Barack Obama and Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, the Iraqi government said it hoped U.S. troops can be out of Iraq by 2010, more or less Obama's timetable. And that news more than likely sent researchers in the U.S. to their computers. Today we want to take a look at how campaigns are using sophisticated computer models that gather tons of data from the world of marketing to figure out how voters are responding to every blip of political news. It's called micro-targeting. For instance, there's even new facial recognition software that claims it can analyze your reaction at a campaign rally, then track you down and send you emails on the issues that seem to move you the most. Politics Magazine set out to find the next big thing in micro-targeting, micro-targeting 2.0, if you will. Christy Findlay is managing editor. Christy, before we hear what's new, put this in context. How old is micro-targeting? How has it already been used?
I like to compare micro-targeting to political advertising in general. If you take an advertisement on the television and you call that a broad brushstroke, it reaches hundreds of thousands of people. Micro-targeting really digs down to one person, to one household, to one street, to one community. The commercial industries have been using this for several decades, but it's very expensive, so political campaigns have only just started catching up. They did some trial runs in 2002. The Republicans did, and a firm called Target Point Consulting, led by Alex Gage, turned up some really good results. And the pollster for George Bush that year was Matthew Dowd, and he invested $3.2 million in Target Point, which looked at the most important districts for George Bush and really started looking at who could be turned out that weren't normal voters. You know, you need to get to 50.1% on Election Day. That's all you really need. And it was so successful in Ohio, targeting very small groups of voters, that Bush was able to get to his 50.1.
That was in 2004. But let's look ahead. I mean, just briefly touch on some of these new techniques. A Canadian firm called MicroTarget Media says they're capable of using new facial recognition software that will identify what messages resonate with voters by somehow reading their facial expressions, as we said, maybe during a rally. First of all, how does this work, and how close are they to actually using it?
They're extremely close to actually using it. I spoke with the firm's vice president this weekend, and he was very excited that they're just about to sign on their first big client. But unfortunately, all of this information is so proprietary, he wasn't able to tell me who that might be.
So we don't know yet if you're going to be standing at a Barack Obama rally or at a John McCain event, and maybe your facial expressions are being read, but how would it work?
Well, the way it would work is they have these cameras on huge booms, and you go to a rally and say John McCain is speaking in Miami, and he talks about jobs, he talks about education, he talks about small business owners, and the camera is able to zoom in on one specific person at the rally and watch their expressions, see what they respond to, see what they like. And based on those cameras targeting everybody at the rally, they can see what people in that community are interested in. And it can go even more specific than that. Library books you check out, for example, have a little radio chip in it called an RFID chip, or at Borders or Barnes & Noble. And if you walk out without checking out your book, the sirens will go off. Well, that little chip might be implanted in a keychain that you get on the way into the rally. And you'll know it's there, but you won't know exactly how it's being used necessarily. So they can figure out, they can track your movements at the rally. They can see which booths you are interested in. There's something about education, for example. Then they can figure out who you are. And then next week, or during the Get Out the Vote season, which is about 5 weeks before Election Day, you might start seeing a lot of direct mail coming to your house. You might start seeing that there are phone calls coming in, and they're going to be talking to you about education or whatever you responded to during the rally.
Okay, this is petrifying in some ways. I mean, how would they, first of all, so they have the video camera that's scanning the audience. How does the, and that I can understand, that they can then analyze that data, you know, facial expressions. Oh, they are excited about this, they're frowning about this. But I don't understand the keychain part.
The chip on the keychain just tells the campaign who you are. So sign up for this raffle and enter to win a car, and in exchange we'll give you this keychain. Then as you walk through, they know exactly where you are, and they can use GPS tracking to figure out where in the rally you are.
Okay.
And then target that very specifically when you're watching the event.
If you try to think of thousands of people at a rally, how does this, all of this get distilled?
It happens in real time, which I think is even more amazing. And it's one of the reasons why this is so phenomenally expensive to do. So a campaign manager sitting in the war room can actually watch people, track people at the rally, and see small businesses are really what matters to this community rather than the war in Iraq.
You mentioned tracking in real time. Alex Gage, who, as you said, is sort of the father of micro-targeting, his company's Target Point that started with President Bush and other Republicans, he says that's his goal now, to move from micro-targeting to micro-tracking. How would he apply that? What does he mean by that?
right now, you just do it once. You do your surveys, you put polls out in the community, you talk to 3,000 to 5,000 people. But what they want to do is start looking at how attitudes change over time. And so, for example, if you have a person who is called by campaign headquarters and she says, you know, I heard about the candidate on Jay Leno. I saw him last night and he talked about this and he was really funny and he was really interesting. That immediately goes back into the system. And it's not helpful just for that voter. It's helpful for finding people who are like that voter. So, for example, you might find people who are in her age group, which is a great predictor of whether somebody will vote. You can find people in her income demographic, which is also a very good indicator of how somebody or whether somebody will vote. And you can find the things that she subscribes to, the magazines she reads, the television shows she tends to watch. And you can say, well, she saw him on Leno, so that is an effective way to advertise to this particular demographic. And it just loops back into the campaign headquarters, and it makes the models a lot stronger.
In other words, instead of just defining the groups, you know, heading into, let's say, in June and July, heading into the general election campaign, and the campaign buys that information at that time and continues to work with it for several months, it's fluid. It's constantly updated and changed.
It's a lot more fluid. And, you know, they have daily tracking polls, nightly tracking polls, and you really use it to make it more accurate. And one of the things that we're seeing right now is that genetic algorithms are being used in micro-targeting.
Wait, genetic algorithms? What does that mean?
Well, the survival of the fittest means that the strongest in the species survives to the next generation. Mm-hmm. As a voter, you are a woman, you make a certain amount of money, you live in a certain community, you are a certain age. All of those things define your genetic DNA as a voter. Mm-hmm. The computer is able to take that and run it through a series of very complicated mathematical algorithms and figure out which factors most predict your likelihood to vote for a certain candidate. That doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't even happen in a week. It happens over the course of a month because these programs are so complicated. It takes a tremendous amount of time for the computer to process everything.
In fact, you write about strategic telemetry, which uses neural networking, another algorithm. It's so powerful that they need to use liquid-cooled computers to do the calculations.
Right. The Strategic Telemetry is a firm run by Ken Strasma. This year he signed on for Barack Obama, and Pennsylvania was one of the states that he was working on. And when I was in there talking with him, he had pinned up on his bulletin board just these little bar graphs about how well his micro-targeting had done in Pennsylvania. And there was not very much space between what he predicted and what actually happened. And he made me swear a pact of secrecy not to let it out. But he did say that other micro-targeting models he's done have been accurate within 0.1%.
Christy Finley, managing editor of Politics Magazine. Our conversation today is about micro-targeting. And Christy, going back to Alex Gage, the Republican who got micro-targeting off the ground, he's now searching for what he calls influentials. These are people who influence other people. He's using so-called promoter scores to rate these voters. You say this approach comes right out of Harvard Business School.
The Net Promoter Scores is one example of how the political world is continuing to go back to corporate research. And if you take your likelihood, for example, of recommending a Ford to a friend or coworker, then you rate it on a scale of, say, 1 to 10. And if you are very likely, you're a 10, to recommend it to a friend, then you're somebody that the campaign really wants to talk to. You're an influential. You are most likely to talk to your friends at the grocery store, at the daycare, and say, you know, I really like this candidate. His issues are really something that you should take a look at. And those people that tend to recommend products or candidates based on their personalities are the people that will go out into the community and help the candidate spread the word. So you can get more bang for your buck by targeting those people.
It sounds like the way campaigns are going to reach out to voters is changed dramatically. For instance, door-to-door canvassing. It doesn't sound as if you'll do whole blocks with the same message anymore. It sounds as if you're going to be told what issue every address wants to know about.
That is exactly right. You will go to a particular door, but instead of saying, you know, I know that you are very interested in the environment, you might handle it a little bit more subtly so that the person on the other side of the door doesn't feel like you have a camera in their living room. So you might send somebody who is a neighbor of theirs who they know is interested in environmental issues and just let it come up naturally in the conversation. But you can also target them specifically with mailers that look at education, and it will seem very seamless. It will seem very subtle. Like, for example, when you log on to the computer and you tend to see ads based around things that you're interested in. You know, for example, that they're probably based on sites that you visited or keywords that you've plugged in, but it's not so obtrusive that it becomes offensive. It's very, very subtle, and it will probably stay very subtle for several cycles.
I'm looking at some of the other things you found. Google is using geotargeting. What's that?
Well, that's based around AdWords. So if you were to have entered Iowa caucus, for example, into Google, John McCain's ad would pop up, sending you to his website, directing you to how you can donate to his campaign. And he's actually said, the senator said, that for every dollar he spent buying up AdWords on Google, he made about $4 to $7 in fundraising. So it's a very effective way to reach people. Whether or not that's traditional micro-targeting is another question entirely, because this thing has so much buzz and so much hype that everybody these days really wants to say that what they're doing is micro-targeting.
Brian Stultz, who's with a company called Polymetrics, gets a million people to volunteer, and every day he asks 5,000 of them about things and watches how their opinions change and then tries to figure out what makes them change their opinion?
Exactly. And they started this looking at products, commercial products, to find out how they could talk people into buying a Ford, for example. And Brian comes to it with a political background. He used to be specialized in grassroots consulting. So he realized very quickly that this had a lot of promise for political candidates as well. So he started asking questions about political candidates. What made you decide to vote this way? And then looking at how those change over time. So they've actually started applying these to political models and have raised the accuracy of those models about 15%, which is pretty dramatic in political circles.
Yeah. Bob Baskin of Spotlight Analysis has found a group that he calls barn raisers, and these are former Republicans who voted Republican until the ethics and sex scandals of 2006. They were horrified by those issues and switched many of them to Democratic candidates, congressional and otherwise. And he follows them because they only follow ethics issues. They are not as interested in the war in Iraq or the economy. It's ethics issues that drive them, and he can tell a candidate what to say to them.
Exactly. And if they are interested in the war in Iraq, then what they're going to be interested in is personal responsibility. For example, is the U.S. taking its own responsibility for its place in the world? Is Iraq stepping up to the plate and taking responsibility for itself? And doing the right thing is very important to that particular group. So you could speak to a set of voters that don't necessarily hold your same position, but if you explain why you have voted a certain way or how this issue will affect them based on their underlying values, they are much more likely to get a positive result and bring them over to your way of thinking, or at least get them to understand you, so they are more likely to vote for you or at least not vote for your opponent.
So Christy Findlay, again, managing editor of Politics Magazine, who took a look at the latest trends in micro-targeting. What are we to think here? Are campaigns just telling voters what they think voters want to hear? Or are they better able to communicate their true messages to the people who need to hear them?
Well, that's a great question. And I think one of the dangers of micro-targeting is that if you target one community with one message, you really need to make sure that that same message isn't going to turn off voters in another community, because these days information spreads so quickly on the internet and on the television and YouTube, that you really have to be sure that everything that you're saying is all going in the same direction. Obviously, candidates tack to the center or to the right depending on where they are in the race. And we've seen that with both Barack Obama and with John McCain this cycle. But you also need to make sure that you're using micro-targeting to really speak to the voters who might be interested in your message, who don't necessarily always vote, or who might vote for people in the opposing party. But if you can speak to them in a way that really addresses the things that they truly care about, then you might bring them over to your side. And a great example of that actually is West Virginia in 2004. The Republicans targeted coal workers, and specifically in the northwestern and northeastern part of the state, in the coal belt near the Ohio border. And these voters are typically labor union members. They are typically Democrats, but in this particular cycle, they talked about jobs. They talked about job losses. They talked about America as the land of the strong and our role in Iraq. And that really responded. They really responded to that. That resonated with those particular voters.
And the bottom line is, voters, be aware of the assault that's upon us.
It is an assault. It will probably be very subtle, and it would also probably help voters understand better their candidate.
Christy Findlay, managing editor of Politics Magazine. It's just a fascinating look at the latest micro-targeting techniques coming soon to a precinct near you. Christy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now. You know when you have to fiddle around with new technology and new remote? No problem, it's not brain surgery. But what if it is? A brain surgeon calls it the fiddle factor. Also, the new documentary that follows five Indiana teenagers through senior year. That's all tomorrow. Still ahead today, the creator of The List still trying to get Iraqis to the U.S. That's after the news. Here and Now. As many as 5 million Iraqis, nearly one in five, are refugees. They fled their homes. The U.S. promised to let in 12,000 Iraqis this year, but only 6,500 of those have made it so far. For comparison, Sweden took in 40,000. Congress has passed legislation to expand the process of bringing Iraqi refugees in, but our next guest says it's not enough. You might remember Kirk Johnson, a former U.S. Agency for International Development worker in Iraq. He founded the List Project, collecting the names of Iraqis who worked for the U.S. and are now targets. When we last spoke with Kirk, he was just getting over his own serious injuries after a post-traumatic stress accident. He walked out of a second-floor window in his sleep, 60 stitches, many surgeries, but he's now healed and fighting to get his Iraqi friends and hundreds he doesn't know out. Kirk Johnson joins us on the phone now. And Kirk, when we last spoke as well, the list had about 700 names. You've been able to bring in about 10. It felt quixotic then, you know. What's the length of the list now?
I think we're at around 1,300 names. I mean, there are so many names coming in the last month or so, and I can't tell what's triggering that. You know, I think since we last talked, we've managed to help get in roughly 90 or 100 Iraqis. But when you think about what we are capable of as a nation when it comes to helping refugees and then compare it to what is currently in place to help these Iraqis, the ones who have helped us, it's lamentable.
Well, the Bush White House says most of these Iraqis have fled, first of all, to Syria. The U.S. doesn't have relations with Syria, and that it takes a long time to screen them. I mean, do you understand, do you have any concern that you could bring in an Iraqi who might be an insurgent or a member of al-Qaeda in Iraq?
As someone who has spent a fair amount of time living in Fallujah and in other parts of Iraq, I mean, I understand that there are insurgents and people who don't like Americans. What seems to me impossible to comprehend is how an Iraqi who has been cleared in background checks by our own United States government intelligence agencies, who has himself been targeted by terrorists, and had family members abducted or tortured, how we could get to a point where we see those Iraqis as potential terrorists is beyond me. And it's, in my opinion, unacceptable. What I've been pushing for lately is something that we sort of euphemistically refer to as the Guam option. In 1996, there was a failed coup in the north of Iraq, and there were several thousand Iraqis that were seen to be allied with the United States. And President Clinton surveyed the normal refugee resettlement program, which is what we're wrestling with now, and realized that it would not work quickly enough to help these Iraqis. And so you know what he did? He ordered an Operation Pacific Haven, which airlifted out roughly 7,000 Iraqis to our military base in Guam, where they were kept safe from Saddam, and Americans were kept safe from any potential bad apples, and we were allowed to process them quickly. We didn't have to negotiate with Syria or anything like that.
Where did they go after Guam?
They're now American citizens. And a lot of them have helped us in the current war. And there's no reason to believe that we can't do this again. And then there are people within the State Department who have been whispering and suggesting this, and they're getting shot down. We've done this in 1998 with ethnic Albanians, 14,000 of them. The Brits are doing this with their Iraqis. They're putting them on airplanes, and they're flying them to military bases and processing them there.
We should say the British and Denmark. When those two countries left Iraq, they took all of their workers with them. But there are so many thousands more who worked for the U.S. I saw you on 60 Minutes. And saw as you went to Jordan, where many of these refugees are, your phone ringing off the hook. You say that you've had, you know, an increase in requests in the last couple of months. How does it work? I mean, do they approach you directly, a friend of a friend? What happens?
Well, there's a lot of it is word of mouth. A lot of it is because of because Marines and soldiers and diplomats and aid workers know about the project, they refer the cases and the details of their endangered staff.
But when we say list, I mean, it isn't just a list of names. It's a book thick with information about the people who want to get out, but also copies of notes of threats that have been made against them. What are some of those? What are people...
Oh, I think the list weighs nearly 100 pounds now. I mean, it's loaded with the documentation that these Iraqis have. I mean, these are the most documented refugees on the planet. A lot of them, as I mentioned earlier, have background checks from the U.S. government. They have letters of recommendation and performance evaluation reports from the Department of State. They have award letters and certificates. They've got their badges that they were given to be given access into our military bases. One of the other important steps that we do is that we find their American supervisor and ask them for an updated support letter. And so it's not just us vouching for them, but it's that Iraqi's own boss who's pitching in and trying to help out and tell the U.S. government, yes, I worked with this person. Yes, I support his resettlement request, and we need to help him.
What are some of the, I know the threats that have been made against these Iraqis are also included in this huge book that you've put together. What are some of the things you're reading?
Oh, I mean, it's the most horrific language. I mean, it's, you know, we will run our blades across the throats of the followers of the occupation and the worshipers of the infidels and things like that. There are so many different death threats that all basically say the same thing. You've got 3 days to clear out. Otherwise, we're going to kill you or someone in your family. So we've got this ridiculous situation where, you know, an Iraqi could receive an award letter and a commendation letter on a Monday, and on Tuesday be photographed leaving the green zone, and on Wednesday receive a death threat, on Thursday they flee, and on Friday we say we can't help them quickly enough because they might be a terrorist. The story is that the surge has succeeded, but what that doesn't address is that an Iraqi who has been helping the United States of America is tainted by that collaboration for life. So it seems to me that we're getting to a point where we're losing our grip on our moral compass here, and we need a president to come in and say to our nation and to the Iraqis and to the rest of the world, no, we have not been terrorized. We've not gotten to the point where we view our friends as enemies. And I think in saving these people and helping them, it's not declaring that the game is over in Iraq or anything like that. It's simply a reassertion of the great American values that all of us believe in.
Kirk Johnson, founder of the List Project, the nonprofit organization trying to resettle Iraqis who are in danger because they were affiliated with the U.S. inside Iraq. Kirk, we'll link to everything on our website, and thanks so much for catching us up. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And a quick heads up on upcoming stories on Here and Now. Author Salman Rushdie is going to be here in the coming days. His latest novel, The Enchantress of Florence. Also historian Howard Zinn on telling his view of history through cartoons. That's in the days ahead. Before we go today, our summer jazz picks. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, as we said early in the program, nearly 7 years after the 9/11 terror attacks, the first war crimes trial since World War II began at Guantanamo Bay this morning with a not guilty plea from the former driver for Osama bin Laden. Salim Hamdan is accused of aiding terrorism and conspiring with al-Qaeda leaders to kill American service members. Hamdan is being tried by a military judge and a military jury that was selected this morning. Joining us from the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba is Carol Rosenberg, a reporter for the Miami Herald. She's been there, been reporting, and Carol, we're so grateful you could step out. I know it's probably a shaky cell phone, but we're grateful to hear from you. Describe the scene and the mood in the courtroom today, because the world is watching.
Hi, Robin. You know, it's a big deal. They brought in the jury pool to actually hear the first one of these war crimes trials. It's the first U.S. war crimes tribunal since World War II, and they brought in 5 or 10 jurors. There's Navy captains and an Army major. There's a Marine lieutenant colonel. And the defense and the prosecution are questioning them and figuring out which 5 to 10 U.S. military officers will hear the case.
Well, and what, you know, what was the mood in the courtroom? How did Hamdan seem? What was the, you know?
You know, it got off to kind of an interesting hitch. Hamdan, the driver, who says he's Osama bin Laden's driver, worked as Osama bin Laden's driver, but never joined al-Qaeda, showed up in his tan prison uniform. Someone forgot to clean his Yemeni business attire, and they found it rolled up in a ball at the courthouse and ran it to the cleaners in downtown Guantanamo near the McDonald's. And he turned up in court first in the uniform and later changed up to a very nice white robe, tan suit jacket, and headscarf. That's usually what he wears there, so that was a bit of a like a bump in the road, as it were.
Well, the trial is taking place despite the Supreme Court ruling last month saying detainees could appeal their detentions in U.S. courts. As we talked about last week, a judge has said that this military commission must go forward and then Hamdan can appeal. But what is the case that the U.S. is making? What are they saying he's done?
They're saying he wasn't just the driver, that he was a member of the al-Qaeda inner circle, that he was Osama bin Laden's bodyguard, that he at one point ran weapons for al-Qaeda, and that he should be held responsible as a conspirator in things like the September 11th attacks and the embassy bombings in East Africa. He says nothing of the sort through his lawyers, that he was a guy making $200 a month, and it was a job.
Well, this is seen as something of a test run for these military commissions and questions of whether or not hearsay, which is allowed in these kind of commissions as opposed to, you know, other military trials, whether hearsay is going to be used by the defense or prosecution. Do we get a sense yet of what each side is going to do? I mean, how much has been said?
Well, we know that the military in the Pentagon is going to bring a series of interrogators and people who question the driver about various things he said at various times in his nearly 7 years of detention. The judge said this morning that he's going to exclude some of those interrogations.
He's going to exclude, did you say, exclude?
He's going to exclude some of those interrogations, the ones that were taken at Bagram Air Base, and he's looking at some of the other ones. He didn't explain why, but he was interrogated by FBI agents, by a former New York City police officer, and there was quite a bit of interrogating going on at Bagram, and the judge has decided not to include it at trial.
Well, and that doesn't say whether or not the judge is deciding that, for instance, waterboarding was involved and whether or not waterboarding is torture. These are some of the questions that were expected to come up during the course of this trial.
Yes, except, Robin, waterboarding is not alleged in the case of the driver. That's in the case of people who were held by the CIA. We haven't heard about waterboarding in this particular episode, but there are some questions of some techniques that may have been used on him. Sleep deprivation, solitary confinement, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Carol Rosenberg, a reporter for the Miami Herald, joining us on the line from the U.S. Naval Base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where the first military commission trial of a detainee there has just begun today, and she's stepped out during a break. Carol, we very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, cool jazz for hot summer days, including Wynton and Willie together in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, we found ourselves wondering recently, what's on James Isaacs' CD player? And so, Here and Now jazz aficionado James Isaacs is here now in the studio with us with his selections for a summer night.
And a summer day.
And who is that man playing the saxophone faster than the speed of light?
Robin, that's James Carter. He is one of the former Young Lions, and they are now moving into early but highly productive middle age. Incidentally, he was just heard playing the baritone saxophone like a ripsaw, not so easy to do. And that's one of the many reed instruments he not only plays with aplomb, but Carter can take apart and put together all of his instruments.
And what other instruments does James Carter play?
On the new album from Mercury called Present Tense, he's heard on flute, bass clarinet, soprano saxophone, tenor saxophone, and baritone saxophone. So I guess I would call him a multi-reed man as opposed to Eric Dolphy, for example. James Carter is nearing 40 years old. He'll turn 40 in January of next year. And on the new album, he leads a sextet. At times, it's augmented by a percussionist. Mm-hmm. By the way, the tune that we just heard is called Hymn of the Orient. And I want to give us a little taste, one more taste of the new Carter album in just a bit.
Okay, and I wanted to ask you, too, because you say he's one of the former Young Lions. Mm-hmm. Just throw out a few other names. Who were they?
Well, I guess the godfather of the Young Lions would be Wynton Marsalis. Mm-hmm. And his brother Branford, and then you've got Nicholas Payton, another trumpet player from New Orleans, Herlin Riley, the drummer. The list goes on and on. Mm-hmm. Reginald Veal, the bassist. Wynton Marsalis made it cool for young African-American musicians not to choose to play funk, but to go in a jazz direction.
And he goes in many other directions as well, as we're going to see.
Yes,
because your next choice features what would seem at first blush to be an unlikely pairing.
It would.
Including Wynton Marsalis and Willie Nelson.
That's true. It's a new album called Two Men with the Blues. But you know, Robin, the thing is they're not really from two different worlds at all because both are musical omnivores. Their common ground is the blues, even though Willie is considered country and Wynton, of course, is jazz. Willie recently turned 75 years old and he's got his cowboy soul working throughout this new album. And Wynton, again, the original Young Lion, going back to the early 1980s, he's now 46 years old, and he has his bluesiest Louis Armstrong trumpet phrasings at the ready. So, here are Willie Nelson and Wynton Marsalis doing a bluesy version of Nightlife.
When the evening sun goes down, you're gonna find me hanging around a nightlife ain't no good life, but it's my life.
That's just great. When you think that that's, you know, that this is anything that Willie Nelson is involved with, and you hear that sound.
And I love the way that Willie phrases, sometimes just behind the beat, sometimes ahead of the beat.
Yeah, yeah. We just heard the applause. Is some of this recorded live?
All of it recorded live at one of those smaller rooms at Lincoln Center, and I'm sure they packed the place.
Yeah. Well, how about the rest of the album?
To me, it's just superb. I've chosen another track from it, and the track I've chosen really put Willie Nelson on the crossover map forever and ever. In 1978, this was the title tune from Willie's album called Stardust. They do it here, and they do it just gorgeously.
But that was long ago, and now my consolation is in the stardust of a song. And beside the garden wall, when stars are bright, and you are in my arms, and the nightingale tells his fairy tale of paradise where roses grew.
It's Wynton's quintet with Willie Nelson's longtime harmonica player joining them.
Mickey Raphael.
As always, we'll have the list of what's on James' CD player for you at our website, here-now.org. But that's Two Men with the Blues, Willie Nelson and Wynton Marsalis. What have you got next?
This is the Brad Meldow Trio, also recorded live in New York, in this case at the Village Vanguard. They made this album, a two-disc set for Nonesuch, last fall. The album is called At the Village Vanguard. It's pianist Brad Meldow, bassist Larry Grenadier, drummer Jeff Ballard, and they really seem to have ESP in much the way that the Bill Evans Trio with Scott LaFaro and Paul Motion did. Now listen to the way that Brad Meldow and his cohorts breathe together on this Meldow original, Ruby's Rub.
Hand in glove.
And it's a complex structure, this tune. I'm sure they rehearsed it extensively, but when you see them on the bandstand, it's so natural, and he has such a wonderful touch, Brad Meldow. I really love his playing.
I know you want us to hear a little more of his playing. Tell us about that.
All I want you to do is hear Brad Meldow's crystalline piano introduction to a piece written by the Brazilian singer-songwriter Chico Buarque. This, my friends, is a little bit of heaven in just over 1 minute. It's got passion, desire, articulation, perfect choice of chords, and an adoration of the melody. Brad Meldow, who turns 40 in August and is at the peak of his powers, this is called O Que Será, What Will Be.
Well, he makes that sound easy. And it's not.
No, it's not. It's deceptively simple, the way that he plays that beautiful melody, but in no way is it an easy thing at all.
Okay, that's Brad Meldow's Live at the Village Vanguard. Yep. Terrific choice.
Two-disc set, Nonesuch Records.
And we know, as you said, you want to play something else from the James Carter CD, the first one we spoke of, Present Tense. What would that be?
Well, this is a tango-flavored Carter original, and he says it was inspired by a dream he had about Billie Holiday. It's called Susanita, and as you can hear, Carter has switched from baritone saxophone to tenor. James Carter, again, not just a multi-reed man, but a multi-reed man with a great sense of how to phrase melodically.
James Carter from James Isaacs with his summer picks for your CD player. You can't go wrong. James, you are a multi-jazz enthusiast.
Well, thank you, Robin.
And thank you for the suggestions.
I hope to see you soon.